This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 31st of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme, Nigeria holds its breath as the country awaits for confirmation of the final election results. Former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari looks to be ahead of President Goodluck Jonathan in the vote count. John Everard and Jeffrey Kaufman will be here to discuss this and some of the other news stories of the day. In Lausanne, Iran and the six world powers push for a nuclear deal as the clock ticks towards a self-imposed deadline. We'll also look at China's new creation, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Many countries are queuing up to join it, but do they actually know what purpose it will serve in the future? And we'll ask if it's possible to practice diplomacy without using diplomatic language. Plus, analyse a kitchen-related election campaign gaffe or two. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, on Monocle 24. Well, my guests today are regular Monocle contributors, journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard, the former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome, gentlemen. Well, let's begin today's show in Nigeria, where the main opposition has today claimed victory in a tense general election, in which former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari has been pulling ahead of President Goodluck Jonathan. If confirmed, this would be the first democratic change of power in the most populous country in Africa. The main candidates just last week made a deal promising to respect the election results and asking their supporters to refrain from violence. In 2011, over 800 people lost their lives in post-election violence. Jeffrey, what are the chances that we won't see violence this time, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think we can now report that the Electoral Commission in Nigeria has actually confirmed the victory, and that's being reported by Al Jazeera, amongst others, as we go to air here, Monocle 24 being on top of the news. I think that, this is a really interesting one to watch. Goodluck Jonathan, endearingly named but very corrupt man who ran that country through all sorts of scandals and, of course, Boko Haram. Nigeria is an important country geopolitically. Many people may have trouble finding it on the map, but as you noted, it's the biggest country in Africa. It's an emerging economy, a major oil producer, and driven by division. As an emerging democracy, it's terribly unstable, and losing is seen as in so many emerging democracies, a point of honor or a loss of honor. So, the possibilities of violence, of course, are always present in these kind of unstable emerging democracies. I think what's really interesting in this, as a journalist, is the character of Buhari. He's 72 years old. This is a man who pretty much all of his 72 years has wanted to run this country. He orchestrated and led a coup in, I think, 1983, was leader for 18 months, and then ran three times in the last decade or so to be president and failed, and now he is victorious at 72. I think he calls himself a converted Democrat. So what a one to watch.
John, that notion of the violence, so what's intriguing is, of course, it's riven by religion, it's based on faith, and that is the fissure that runs through this. And also, I'm just seeing that before we came on air, that already the supporters of Goodluck Jonathan are quite openly saying that they don't believe the election results. They're criticising the election officials. They're claiming that the counts of Buhari were called too quickly, that there are kind of missing thousands of votes for their man. So it doesn't look as though this is going to be an easy transition, does it?
No, it doesn't. I think the biggest shock would be if Goodluck Jonathan's team don't dispute the result. Remember, this will be the first time in Nigerian history that a government in power has been peacefully overthrown through the ballot box. And there's no sign that the transition of this great experiment in democracy is going to be entirely straightforward. As it is, Abuja is now closed down. Shops and offices are deserted. People are expecting violence on the streets. So far, there doesn't appear to be any. But I think as the message cuts home to the PDP team, Goodluck Jonathan's losing team, that they are out of power, they are likely to get really quite irate. Yes, they will accuse the Electoral Commission of fraud. None of the foreign observers seem to support that claim. The view seems to be that the election wasn't entirely perfect. There were irregularities. But nothing to put into question the massive 3.4 million vote lead that Buhari had when the result was declared. So the hope is that we can expect a few days of bad temper, but that the result will be accepted and that Buhari will be sworn in.
And John, I think that this is part, you're a scholar of developing nations, this is part of the road to a more stable democracy. The road is not a paved one. It is filled with potholes. And you know, as the significant thing here is what you opened with, Andrew, this is the first peaceful transition of power. Now, it may not be completely peaceful. So I think what we have to watch for is the degrees of unrest. I mean, obviously, if the country burns for weeks, then this is a catastrophe. But if there are some rumblings that settle down, then that is progress, is it not?
That would be real progress. And you're right. I mean, this is something that democracies go through. Nobody likes losing elections. And losing elections with a certain amount of grace and calm, it takes practice. And the Nigerians haven't had that practice yet.
But some people would say that road to democracy has been a very long road. And we certainly, you know, we may have a democratic election here, that, and maybe the votes will be agreed upon. US election officials have already said that they don't see too much gerrymandering. They think it's, you know, the results should be followed. But Jeffrey, I wonder what's, you know, a bigger question really is a question of, you know, the corruption within Nigeria, which is, can anybody deliver on clean government? It seems to be so endemic. Anybody who does business there, who visits even, who even tries to get through the airport on arrival, knows that there's a culture of small bribes paid here, bigger bribes paid there. You can't do business without kind of greasing the wheels a bit. And for anybody to unpick that, it just seems almost impossible, because that's what Goodluck Jonathan came in saying he would do as well.
I think you're right. I think that's one of the two big questions that loom over Nigeria, and I think frankly over the entire developing world, and to a certain in the former Soviet satellite states, this is, you know, along with environmental issues, perhaps nuclear disarmament, these are the issues of our time, and you're right. How do you break the cycle of corruption? And Nigeria is one of the worst. It is so rich with oil and so polarized. 175 million people. It is a huge country and it matters. And there isn't, it's hard to see where Buhari, you know, I think Buhari's election maybe comes out of the chaos and the horror of Boko Haram saying what we need is a guy with an iron fist. And he certainly has demonstrated that. Can he be a Democrat with an iron fist is the question.
And John, what's, I guess, interesting about that, the Boko Haram element is, you know, for Western governments, they're very concerned to have, you know, a stable government and somebody they can count on to battle with Boko Haram.
Well, yes, that's right. Buhari is, after all, ex-military. He's, if anybody is going to be able to wield that fist within the democratic system, it's going to be him. And nobody has made any announcements yet, but I suspect that his victory will be quietly welcomed by a lot of Western governments. On corruption, we know the way you treat corruption is by making it more dangerous for corrupt officials to accept the bribe than not accept the bribe. Essentially, it's the Chinese approach. You shoot enough people until the others get the message. Is Buhari going to do that? Let's see.
I think I might add that sitting here in London, surrounded by 10, 20 million pound homes bought by, amongst other things, the relatives of Nigerian officials, it would help if some of these countries would stop letting numbered companies buy real estate and hide stolen money. I think the West could do a lot more if it really wanted to.
Yes, but the West doesn't, does it?
Well, they kind of like this money coming in, don't they?
It certainly helps the housing bubble here. Well, let's leave Nigeria for now and move to the latest reports about negotiations deciding the future of the Iranian nuclear program. Iran and six world powers are pushing for a deal as the clock ticks towards a self-imposed deadline at the end of today. The United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia and China have been trying to break an impasse in the talks for nearly a week. John, where do you think we are? Was intriguing as, you know, the bellwether for this seems to be, you know, whether Sergei Lavrov is on a plane towards or away from Switzerland, and he's back in town, and he obviously wants to be around if there's any kind of deal signed. Do we feel that there's an interim agreement about to be announced?
Everybody is keeping their card very close to their chests, and it's very hard, therefore, to work out what the probabilities are. The word coming out of the negotiating chamber is that they are making progress, but there are still some sticky issues to be resolved. The fact that Lavrov is there is a very strong indicator of confidence. And not only would he want to be around if a deal is struck, he probably would not want to be around if there is a fiasco. So somebody has convinced him that this is worth sticking around for. The other big indicator of progress is the fact that they have raised these negotiations to foreign minister level. You don't commit the prestige of your foreign minister unless you believe that there's a real chance of a deal being done. Now, I think it's too early to pop any champagne corks, but this is by far the best chance we've had to reach an agreed settlement of the Iran nuclear issue for many, many years. And I, for one, am hoping against hope that the chance doesn't slip away.
Jeffrey, we say that we hope the chance doesn't slip away, but this is a deal fraught with danger. What's intriguing is, you know, if you're sitting in Tehran, you must feel this is one of the best moments ever. You see, you know, the governments backed by you or organizations backed by you taking power in Yemen, pushing through in Idlib in Syria, of, you know, the rise of Iranian-backed troops and militia in Iraq, and seemingly about to retake Tikrit. Plus, you're getting the deal on the nuclear weapons as well. It would be an amazing resurgence for Iran, wouldn't it?
You know, we talked about losing gracefully when we were talking about Nigeria, and I think that one of the themes that can't be ignored here is that Iran feels that through modern history it has been humiliated, it has been vanquished, and part of the key to successful negotiations is not rubbing, is allowing Iran to walk away with a sense of dignity. The West has to be able to answer to its clients, its voters, its public, its parliaments. But this isn't going to work if there isn't in some way a manner for Iran to feel, to say, particularly to mollify the conservatives who don't want to be seen to be acquiescing to the West. And so, you know, that's the balancing act that we're watching here.
But what's amazing for both of you is that, you know, here on Monocle 24, only a couple of years ago, we were discussing, you know, will the Israelis bomb Iran and take out these nuclear facilities? You know, that moment passed, and the Israelis have, you know, they sense they've lost control of this whole situation. But the Saudis are furious about this deal as well. They're concerned about the rise of Iran. So even now, although all these key nations are backing it, there are many people on the sidelines, don't you think, who would like to see this fall apart?
Absolutely. The Saudis have long memories, and it's important to recall that not so very long ago, Iran was a staunch US ally. The last time I was there, there were Shah memorials everywhere and big American flags on some of the buildings. You don't get that so much these days, but that is a part of Iranian history. And I think that the Saudis are concerned not just about what Iran might do in terms of proxy wars around the region, but that situation might one day return. And now, if I had said that 2 years ago, you'd have thought I was completely stupid. But here we are, as I say, with the possibility of a deal on the nuclear issues and evident coordination between Iranian and Western-backed forces on the ground in and around the fight against ISIS. Again, if you'd said that a few months ago, people would have thought you were mad, but it's happening. We're nowhere near a big rapprochement yet, but these are the first steps towards that.
I think it's also... Saudi gets a free pass these days because Iran is such a petulant and problematic outsider, and I think Saudi, as a Sunni country watching Shia Iran try to reintegrate itself and try to lift these onerous sanctions, sure you can bet they're not happy about it, but the balance of power may be better in that region, if there are two players being listened to, and rather than one and one being Saudi and the other being ostracized.
Yeah. Well, can I just throw in here, yeah, another country that is watching these talks with a bit of American interest is North Korea. That Pyongyang has worked out that if Tehran can get a deal, then maybe so can Pyongyang. Watch this space.
Well, the Saudis will make another appearance in this show in a little while. But it's also a good note that we've just been working on a story which is about the number of Western business people already flying in from Dubai into Tehran looking at opportunities. I think most of those have bet that there is a deal that's going to be made. But we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard. When we come back, China's new financial institution, the AIIB. Is it a worthwhile investment?
From a 71-year-old barber to a century-old cafe owner, Monocle Films visits Japan's sprightly elderly who are showing little sign of letting up.
For many in this long-living country, the official retirement age is merely a number. Up and down the country, many people in Japan are working well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes even beyond. 100-year-old Ichiro Sekiguchi says that working has kept him fit. Today, he is still in charge at Café de l'Ombre, the coffee house he opened in Ginza in 1948.
Older, wiser, and going strong. Senior style in Japan. Premiering now in the film section on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. The time in London is 18:16. And still with me are Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard. It was only 5 months ago that China established the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or the AIIB. Well, the new development bank has already become a major headache for the US, which is helplessly seeing its allies show support for the new financial institution. The new bank will be a bit like the World Bank, offering loans to Asia's developing countries for infrastructure projects. But much of the bank's practices depend on the articles of agreement that are being drafted at a meeting of prospective adherents in Almaty, which ends today. John, how important is... I think, first of all, we should say this has been a really kind of strange diplomatic moment for the Chinese. I don't think they realised how many people would sign up for it. The Americans are being completely, you know, dumbfounded by the willingness of the likes of the UK to kind of quickly put their initials next to it. How important is this for China?
This is very important for China. China is sulking, understandably, because the United States Congress refused to allow the changes to the articles of the IMF and the World Bank, which would have reflected the growing economic power of China. And, you know, China, in disgust, has set up its own shop, effectively. Some would say a rival to what the Chinese regard as US-dominated financial institutions in Asia-Pacific, IMF, World Bank, and, of course, the Asia Development Bank. Others say that, as a reminder, that the ADB, a few years ago, worked out that in this decade, so 2010 to 2020, Asia needed $8 trillion of investment. So there's plenty of room there. I mean, you don't have to be rivals, that there are projects going begging. The big question is what kind of bank this is going to be. Is this going to be a corrupt Chinese-run slush fund where they simply lend money to their friends without much transparency? Or is it going to be a properly run, board-directed, transparent institution that could do a great deal of good in Asia?
But gentlemen, if we don't even know that, if it's, you know, a slush fund or a bank for good, why the hell are all these countries signing up to it?
Because they believe that the way to turn it into a force for good and away from a slush fund is to sign up for it, get your voting rights, and hammer out the right articles of agreement, which is what they're doing in Almaty now. In Almaty, it is 20 past 10 at night, I think, and they are still talking. I was expecting an announcement by now of some kind of conclusion to the meeting. It hasn't happened, which of itself is really interesting. Either it's possible this got bogged down in technical stuff, but it's also possible that we've had encountered a clash of visions for this bank between the Chinese on the one hand and the West, possibly with the Russians and the Indians on the other. If that's the case, that's going to be a big story and a big spotlight on the way that China behaves in the world.
I wonder whether this exceeds China's wildest dreams. I mean, we just had today Norway and Taiwan agreeing to join. And part of the reason there's a rush, as John pointed out, is that if you join by April 15th as a founder, you have voting rights, you can help shape this. So presumably Norway Norway's motive is to get in there and help structure this. And maybe, you know, what John says is interesting. Maybe behind closed doors, the Chinese are grinding their teeth and saying, wait a minute, all these countries are going to outvote us. And, you know, we may have to be more accountable. Certainly, I think what John says is clearly that's what we have to watch. China has used its foreign investment in very nefarious ways in Africa, in Asia, in South America, and not necessarily for the good of those countries, but only for the exploitation of those countries in a kind of post-colonial mineral exploitation and sort of hewers of wood, drawers of water kind of to fuel the Chinese economy. This is an interesting one, but, you know, it really is an exercise. If it's legitimate, and perhaps if it's not, it's an exercise in soft power. I mean, China is betting that this is a better investment than building another aircraft carrier. And it's a, you know, on that level, it's very shrewd. It shows a maturity of their thinking.
It does. Two other sort of nuggets on this. It came out in the last few hours that the Chinese prospective chairman for this bank has refused an application by North Korea to join, on the grounds that North Korea was unable to provide anything that looked like economic statistics. This is a good sign. I mean, if they'd let North Korea in, I think we'd have drawn the worst possible conclusions. The other point I do want to make is that at this point, the smart thing for China is to call the US bluff, to play absolutely by the rules, and to allow an institution to be created which China may not in the end dominate, but which is run by a board, and then turn to the US and say, you have for decades said you wanted to become responsible international stakeholders. As soon as we do that, you shout at us, just what do you want? And here's a good, clean bank for you.
Now, I said we'd return to the topic of Saudi Arabia, and there's a little spat going on between the Saudis and Sweden. In fact, just today, the Saudis have announced that their ambassador will soon return to Sweden. The reason he left? Well, the foreign minister of Sweden, Margot Wallström, announced in a speech to Parliament that Saudi Arabia was a dictatorship that violated women's rights and whipped bloggers. And around the same time, Sweden cancelled a long-standing military cooperation deal between the two countries too. She's certainly got form on this, speaking her mind. She called Vladimir Putin's government a reign of terror. It's great to see a Swedish foreign minister saying what she thinks. And sorry to begin with you again, John, but I know you've been in this world of diplomacy. Is this a breath of fresh air, or is this a rather foolish person?
I think, I mean, what she said, of course, is right. But it's the kind of thing you say direct to the government you're trying to get the message to behind closed doors. Saying these things in public and embarrassing the government, especially when you're dealing with a country as sensitive on these issues as Saudi, can be counterproductive. Now, in the end, Sweden has got away with this. They've made this statement. The Saudis have withdrawn their ambassador and then returned him, and life will go on. And because Saudi made such a fuss, everybody will remember what Sweden said. So in a sense, the Saudis have shot themselves in the foot. But it could have gone much nastier. It was a dangerous game to play.
Sweden Listen, thank God for the Scandinavians. I mean, you know, somebody has the nerve, to use a polite word, to speak the truth. And what's really interesting is that Sweden is trying to exercise what I think they call an ethical foreign policy, which, John, you've been a diplomat. Is that an oxymoron?
I used to try to implement Robin Cook's ethical foreign policy. It's left me scarred for life.
But you know, she spoke the truth, or she spoke her truth to Israel, and calling on the EU to recognize Palestine. Israel withdrew its ambassador. She offended Russia. She offended Saudi. It's pretty hard to take issue with the motive here. She is not a wild card. She has a consistent philosophy. Could other countries get away with it? Do you have to be a rich Northern European country of the nature of Sweden to do this? Probably. But you know, good for them.
But do you think there's a balance between you? I guess a foreign minister has two audiences. It has the public, and this will go down well with the public, who feel that she's speaking to Nordic ideals and she's explaining what Sweden believes in. But actually, the next time you try and influence a government, they're going to be cautious. They're going, they, you know, she loses some credibility or some influence, don't you think?
I think so. I think, firstly, I'm not sure that I buy into the idea that foreign ministers sit there calculating their remarks according to, you know, how they think an audience is going to react. Foreign ministers have a disconcerting habit of simply saying what they think. These are human beings, and I suspect that is what happened in this case. But I suspect also that for somebody who is so frank in her remarks, people are going to be just a little bit cautious about what they tell her in future. I mean, if she says something like this in public, suppose that she then moves on to revealing details of confidential conversations in public, which, of course, we were talking about on this program not long ago, causes all kinds of ructions.
But John, it's Sweden. I mean, you know, they're an interesting country and they're an exotic country and there are lots of things to praise about Sweden, but it's generously a middle power. Does it matter that people don't tell her things? I mean, they're not big influencers of the world. They're just,
But I think every foreign minister would like to hope they were.
Sure. But I think most foreign ministers know that if they're not American, you know, if they're not sitting at the UN Security Council, or they don't have representatives there, they're not.
Well, we've got one more big story to fit in. And we have to have we have another Nordic big failure on the diplomatic front, diplomatic at home. Anyway, in the UK recently, we saw that the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, get in trouble when he was photographed in his kitchen. And it turned out to be only his second kitchen, which didn't go down well with his voters when he was trying to tell them he was a man of the people. But Ed's not alone. Another kitchen-related election gaffe recently took place in Finland, where parliamentary elections are also only a few weeks away. The country's finance minister, Antti Rinne, just published his favourite recipe. But the Finnish media was quick to point out that the portions seem to be somewhat out of scale. According to nutrition experts, the pasta involved around 10,000 calories. And the Finnish election candidate has been forced to explain to the voting public that his dish, already nicknamed heart attack pasta, was not meant to be eaten by just one person. In fact, the full recipe includes 500 grams of pasta, nearly a kilo of bacon, and another kilo of cheese, and rather modestly, 1.5 red peppers. John, should the politicians stay out of the kitchen?
No, I'm all in favour of politicians learning to cook. But I love this theme of pre-electoral gaffes. My own favourite, if I could just bring it to the table here, no pun intended, was the one that David Cameron made just before the 2010 election, where, again, trying to portray himself as a man of the people, he was filmed cycling to work. And then a rather unkind cameraman panned out and showed that behind the cycling David Cameron, there was a car driving behind him at cycle pace carrying his briefcase. So not that great an environmental move.
Jeffrey, you're taking this. These are all attempts by people to try and appear normal. The fact is, if you spend your life in politics, fighting every day, sitting in parliament, you're not normal.
I'm going to date myself and give listeners a sense of just how old I really am. And back to Canada in my childhood, one of my early political memories, I think a lot of people may remember Pierre Trudeau, but they probably don't remember the conservative politician who ran against him, a slightly awkward man named Robert Stanfield, whose election campaign was summed up in one photograph, which very much the age we're in, where photographs really, really cement the image. He was trying to be a man of the people. He was catching a football, and that's an American football, okay, or a Canadian football, in fact, but a pigskin, as we call them. And the football went through his hands, and the photographer caught it just as it was going through his hands, and it became a metaphor for a man who just couldn't quite get it. And, you know, these things sometimes happen through just an uncomfortable moment, but they really do have enduring legacies at times that you just can't escape. And there's the moment in the U.S. presidential debate when George H.W. Bush looked at his watch, suggesting that he was impatient, and man, he got hammered for that.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. But Marcus Hippie, who is the producer of the show, is Finnish, and he has asked for this dish to be put on at the Monocle Cafe, so you can head down there to see how good or bad it is. Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, he's the Finn, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Moneta. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half an hour, Marcus will be here to keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Tom Morris. And at 2200 hours, the Monocle Daily is here with Andrew Muller and Peter Cardwell. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours. Here in London, that's 1300 hours in New York. I'm Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening.